at Allaire.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. George W. Bush is on the road again. He spent last night in Bill Clinton's old town. Today he's in Atlanta selling a tax cut plan worth $1 trillion+ to the American people. Tuesday, the president took center stage in his first address to a joint session of Congress, talking about the cut and other issues he ran on during the campaign, increasing education spending, strengthening the military, and supporting faith-based organizations. The address to Congress in many ways marked Bush's debut as a president. Leon Panetta, the former chief of staff to President Clinton, noted that a president's first budget speech is really his last campaign speech. From now on, Panetta said, the task is governing, not campaigning. The controversial tax plan is shaping up as Bush's first defining battle, the outcome of which could well be determined by public opinion. So, Connection listeners, you heard about Governor Bush. You've got to meet Candidate Bush. Are you getting a handle on President Bush? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255 makes the President George W. Bush connection. My guest in the studio today is Cece Connolly. She's a national political reporter for The Washington Post. She covered both the Bush and the Gore campaigns, lucky you. And she's a fellow this semester at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Welcome.
John, thank you for having me.
Also with us by phone is Wayne Slater. He's the Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. He's covered Bush for 6 years, lucky you, starting when he first ran for governor of Texas. And like Cece, he spent 18 months on the campaign trail. Hi, Wayne.
Good to be with you, John.
Welcome to The Connection. Cece, I want to go to you first, and I'm just curious about your sense of this, having covered him in the campaign and now watched a couple of press conferences and the speech. Are we seeing him emerge from the shadow of the potential illegitimacy of his governance, as people were worried when he came out of Florida, that he just wouldn't have a solid base? What are we seeing here with this guy?
Sure. I think that there's a natural, what we might call stature increase, that happens with each of these individuals. Once that inauguration day occurs and you see him surrounded by all the trappings of the presidency, that goes a long way in elevating his profile, really. I also think he's getting a little bit more comfortable in the role, although not entirely yet. I mean, if you think back, we watched this with Bill Clinton. Think about his first address to Congress compared to that eighth and final, where he's so comfortable and natural standing up there. So it's a slow process. It's starting to happen.
Part of this is just, you know, can a guy give a decent speech? And and I must say, watching that address, there were a few bloopers, almost none. He read it better than I can sometimes read copy in a studio, which is, I think, an accomplishment. And it was charming, low-key. I thought he did an excellent job. And I'm not a particular Bush fan, but I thought he did an excellent job. Wayne, you've watched him for a long time now. You see any changes from what you saw down in Texas?
Well, it's funny. I both see a lot of change and at the same time, some things never change. In terms of change, I saw him deliver speeches in Austin in 1995 and 1997 to the legislature. And to be charitable, they were not good. He was not particularly charismatic. The speeches were not particularly well written. And although they were fairly well received, largely because he was proposing things that the legislature was already doing, they were not pieces of oratory. Now, the thing the other night was not a soaring piece of oratory, but at the same time, it was an awfully good speech for George Bush. In fact, I would say that may have been the best speech, policy speech, that he has ever delivered.
Is that the product of performance or the writer of the speech?
Well, you know, the writer of his speech during the campaign, Mark Gerson, is an extraordinary speech writer. But this was really not so much the writer of the speech as it was the performer has learned how to perform. And you asked whether I've seen this change, and I have, in terms of a more accomplished speech maker. At the same time, I'm struck by the consistency of the guy. Yesterday in Omaha, as he set out to preach the message here and to sell the public on his tax cut plan, he said, the surplus is not the government's money. The surplus is the people's money. And I thought to myself at the time, 1 year ago today, almost, on March 1st, 2000, I had climbed off the campaign plane in Atlanta, Georgia, where George Bush was still in the Republican primary, and he said to a group, the surplus is not the government's money, that surplus is the people's money.
Let's hear him say that himself. We've got that queued up here.
The surplus is not the government's money. The surplus is the people's money. And I'm here to ask you to join me in making that case to any federal official you can find.
There it is.
John, I was going to say, John, what we see here is someone who has worked and worked and worked on a message and rarely deviates from that message.
1-800-423-8255. We want to get a lot of calls in here. This is your chance on the connection to spout off about your new president. 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie's on the line. Let's hear from Jackie right now. Jackie, welcome to the connection. Oh, we've got a dial tone.
You know, John...
Cece, thank you for jumping in there.
Well, just as Wayne was pointing out, he'd heard that line a year ago. There were many such lines in the speech Tuesday night to Congress that were very familiar to those of us that slogged around on the campaign trail with George Bush. I think that this is all part of... Bush wants to keep to a fairly simple, compact set of goals, message, themes, and it's smart from a political point of view because if he's able to check off a couple of those boxes, he can run around and say, look, I set out four goals. Here, we've checked off one. We've checked off a second. It's a smart approach.
Somebody was pointing out that when Clinton comes in with a budget message, it usually has like 100 small items on it, and it takes him hours to tell you about all of it. And here was a very simple itemized message that is containable and you can, as you say, check it off.
And in fact, that is the George Bush that we've seen for years in Texas in his first legislative session, just a few months after he had been elected, weeks after he had been inaugurated as the governor of Texas in 1995, he set out on an agenda for his first session of four items. And when we pesky reporters would try to move him into other areas, he inevitably moved back to his four items that he wanted to accomplish.
Let's take a call now. Jackie's on the line, I think, now. Jackie, welcome to the connection.
Hi. I have to agree. I think it was a good speech of his, but I don't believe it. I don't think he can accomplish all of those more or less Democratic ideas, the health care and better conditions, and even mentioning environmental protection. All those things are very, very, very worrisome to all of us watching George during the campaign. So I don't believe he's going to do all of these things. But where he seemed especially presidential, considering the background of Clinton the same way, when he bombed Iraq twice, that's what Clinton has been doing, and I think this is a very negative kind of presidential quality. But he's showing his power being president the same way that Clinton did in bombing innocents in Iraq and not caring what we do in a country of our own where we have never experienced this horror, such terror coming from the skies.
What did you...
And he's done that. That's kind of presidential. He's taking over the power. But that's, I think, a very negative kind of quality.
I wonder what you think, Jackie, what you thought when he talked about lingering racism in America. And this is unusual, I think, for... We heard this at the convention, Republican convention, from Colin Powell, but this is fairly unusual for a Republican president to come in and put lingering racism in America that high up in his speech, I think.
Well, I think, as I say, although he mentioned a lot of things that are marvelous and really surprising, and I don't believe them, of course. He does have several persons on his immediate staff of color. That's great, I think, to have for the first time a black man as Secretary of State, Colin Powell. I'm very much admired. He's doing well around the world. However, what happened in Florida was denying black residents there the right of voting, and having their votes counted. He didn't care about that. And I'm not sure what he cares about so many blacks being punished and imprisoned. He didn't mention that. And that's happening in his state also. So many people of color in prison for a very slight reason, for nonviolent crimes.
Jackie, thanks for your call. I was looking at the polls coming in here, and we haven't had any polls out since the speech, but an ABC poll, ABC Washington Post poll just before that, showed a 55% job approval, And they characterize that as the lowest in 50 years, the lowest since Dwight Eisenhower. So
for a new president at the same juncture. Mm-hmm. And I think your point, John, as well as what Jackie was talking about on the line, are really central themes here coming out of not only Tuesday's speech, but for his presidency. It's a very divided country right now. Only half of the people that voted for George Bush, and we see that. And what Jackie was really getting at is how strong the Bush administration and the Bush campaign have been on symbolism. Just think a little about Tuesday night. We had Mayor John Street, the African-American Democrat from Philadelphia, mm-hmm. sitting next to Laura Bush. He quoted John F. Kennedy. He paid tribute to Joe Moakley, the congressman from right here in Boston, who is ill with cancer. He had a joke. He said that he was going to work on racial profiling, patients' Bill of Rights. Those are Democratic issues. He hit all of the right symbols for the audience out there in America that's skeptical about George Bush. But again, Jackie hit it. Is he going to pull these things off?
So would you expect, Wayne, would you expect to see the polls jump up after the speech? Are you anticipating?
Oh, yes. I clearly think the polls will jump a bit after the speech. But the real problem that President Bush has, and he and his folks know it, is not that he will be popular or his approval ratings will climb a bit because he appears to be a good guy striking some moderate themes, or that he's proposing a tax cut. It's whether or not the public really wants that tax cut compared to the things that they would have to give up in order to get it. So the next few weeks, certainly this next couple of months, as it becomes clearer and clearer what programs specifically have to get cut, that's the debate that is going to cause problems for him.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Call us up. Tell us what you think about President Bush. Doug, in the Bronx.
Thank you very much. Hello?
Yeah, you're here, Doug.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome to the connection.
Yes, hi. First of all, on the polls, I think there are very contradictory things going on, because as you began, I was citing that poll to the screener, Tuesday's Washington Post. Dana Milbank wrote that actually that there was only a 22% approval rating for the huge cross-the-board tax cut, and 35% for keeping investing money in Social Security and Medicare, and other parts of it. Everything was under 50%. It seemed that so it's sort of like a lot of pluralities of opinion in that poll. And then yesterday on another NPR show, Talk of the Nation, they cited, I guess it was the Zogby poll, saying that, you know, this is hours after, the next day after the speech, 80% of the people would support a tax cut. So I think some very odd things going on there. I mean, in my opinion, I don't think that speech could possibly have changed so many people's opinion, since it's exactly the same rhetoric we've heard. If you look at history, economic history, tax cuts that favor the wealthy, which this obviously is a tax cut that does that.
Doug, I'm going to have to cut you off. We've got to take a break here. Thank you for calling. We're going to take up your polling issues in the next segment. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in hour number two of The Connection with host John McChesney, listening.
I'm John McChesney. You're listening to The Connection. We're talking about President George W. Bush. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Cece Connolly. She's a national reporter for The Washington Post. She covered the Gore and the Bush campaigns. And Wayne Slater. And Wayne's down there in Austin. He works for the Dallas Morning News and covered the campaign. Wayne, we're going to say goodbye to you right now. Thank you very much for being on The Connection.
Very good to be with you, John. Bye-bye.
We're joined now by Andy Kohut, who is the director of the Pew Research Center. We were talking about polling in the last segment, and we're going to pick up that issue again. Andy, I see that in your poll just before the speech, you were clocking him at 53%, George W. Bush at 53%, and you characterize that as remarkably unremarkable.
That was pretty much on par. I was a little bit surprised by my colleagues at the Washington Post, ABC, coming up with these large numbers for Clinton and other presidents in the past, because when I looked up my polls and looked up Gallup polls, Clinton had a 56 in 293, and Reagan had a 55 in 281. Now, George Bush Sr. had a larger number, 63, and Jimmy Carter had a larger number, 71, in February of their first terms, but of course those two were never reelected. They were first-term presidents. And we also found in open-ended questions, when we asked people, have you heard anything you liked about George Bush since he's been president, or disliked, that more people, 60%, said liked the things they've liked than heard things they disliked, 40%. And even a lot of the Gore supporters, as many as 40%, said they had heard some things that they liked about Bush. So, you know, given the weird election, this seemed to be pretty typical. It might be a bit soft or lower than some of these other presidents, depending upon the level of comparison. But by and large, I think it's the American public trying to accept Bush, wishing him well, doing what they said they would do during the election uncertainty, and that is they would accept either Gore or Bush and do the best to get with their program if the issues were right and if the policies were right and the way he conducted himself in office squared out with their view of the way presidents should act.
When we came out of Florida, everybody was anticipating that this guy would come into office under a great cloud. Do these figures surprise you, given the way we went into the way George Bush assumed the presidency?
Well, I guess I was never a believer in the great cloud theory, and I'm a little less surprised by these figures. I mean, they could be a lot worse than they are. I mean, we only have 21% saying they disapprove of George W. Bush, you know, I think that people want to give him the benefit of the doubt. They want to hear what he has to say. I think these box office positive ratings that were taken, that were found in these instant polls, somebody mentioned the Zogby poll, these polls that are done in 25 minutes,
right,
reflect, you know, the public, you know, saying, hey, he got up there and said some good things, and they like the fact that he's out talking about issues. But the real public opinion takes a little time to settle down, and how people, whether people's attitude toward the tax cut proposals will change, and whether he can build some momentum for them, will take a little bit longer than 25 minutes after a speech.
Well, we're doing our own little instant poll here on The Connection today. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Angela is on the line. Angela, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is that I feel that the media is really giving a free ride to George Bush, and that such low standards have been set for him that, you know, if he can read a speech, he's given high marks, like you were commenting on that, and that it seems to be an analysis more of style than content, and that, you know, there hasn't been a lot of in-depth analysis I haven't seen about the proposals. I mean, the things that I hear are more about, you know, the style of it. I really think the media's been giving him a free ride.
Cece, you're part of that.
Is that my cue to step up to the mic? I certainly think that's a valid point to raise in terms of the coverage. There's been an ongoing sense, especially among many of the Al Gore supporters, that the bar has been lower for George Bush. I think, in fairness to my brethren in the media, it might take a few days to dissect some of these policies. Keep in mind that several, I think it's a 200-page budget, is just landing up on Capitol Hill right now. It takes a while to sift through those things. Many of the things that President Bush mentioned Tuesday night were notions, a commission on racial profiling, a desire to have a patient's bill of rights. It's hard to really dissect a notion or a desire at this juncture.
Sure.
But I think that's gonna come, and that should be the goal of the press coverage in the coming weeks.
Well, one example that I heard, and just things that he says that seem very contradictory. I mean, when he says them, it sounds okay, but if you think about it, he talked about education, how he wants to give power a lot more local authority to school boards, make it real local decisions, but then is an advocate of yearly testing, which, it, you know, might sound okay, but when you really think about it, are two very contradictory things. And I don't know.
That's absolutely right. And one of the lines in the speech that is drawing criticism is when he defended quite nonchalantly the idea of testing to the test, basically, you know, teaching to the test, I guess, is the phrase in educational circles, which is quite controversial.
Mm-hmm. Angela, thank you for your call. David, let's take a call from David in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a comment to make about George Bush's tax plan, which is simply that I don't believe that most people have an idea what it's about, and I'm surprised that the media is so intent on finding out what the public thinks about the tax plan. It seems to me that we would leave that to the experts, and we would ask people, you know, who they're persuaded by, but not what they thought about the tax plan, because I don't think most people have a clue what the tax plan's about. We hear the number $1.7 trillion as though that were something that most people understood.
Andy Cohut, I'm curious about what you've been finding out about the tax cut. Is there a clamor out there for getting your money back?
Well, what we've been finding, I think the caller has a real point. The American public hasn't really heard a lot about the specifics of this tax plan other than it's big. And what we've found recently is that there's not a greater sentiment for using the surplus, devoting the surplus to the tax plan, to a tax cut. Most Americans say the highest priority with that surplus should be making sure that Social Security is shored up and expanding Medicare benefits or improving Medicare. So we know that there's not a great deal of there's not a rise in sentiment that says we want a tax cut relative to these other things.
Actually,
we also know that people in general like the idea of a tax cut, but it's a moderate level of enthusiasm, because most Americans think a tax cut, and this tax cut in particular, will not be a fair one. It will advantage the rich and not do a lot for middle class and poor people. And those attitudes really haven't changed. I mean, Bush has made a little bit of progress. During the campaign, 12% said the tax cut would be fair. It's now up to 26%. But 26% is still a long way to go. So the public is going to learn more about the specifics of this tax cut, its possible consequences, and either stick to its views or change its views about its fairness or its desirability. The only thing it seems to say in a very positive way about it is the better reason for a tax cut than giving relief to people like me is it might stimulate an economy that the public is increasingly worried about.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Robin is on the line. Robin, welcome to The Connection.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I want to just quickly second the remark on low expectations. I think it's very reassuring that we have a leader of the strongest country in the free world that can hire a good speechwriter, spend many hours, I would assume, studying the speech and then actually deliver it without too many mistakes. However, the question I have really is about the tax cut.
Good. That's what we're talking about.
Okay. It seems to me that the tax cut being proposed, apart from, first of all, any tax cut, and I'm talking like Bush right now, but that's because I'm a little nervous. I apologize.
That's all right.
And I haven't had a chance to practice my speech. any tax cut being considered in any administration without the people that are considering it having had an opportunity to carefully review the specifics of the budget is wrong. I can't even put it any other way. Now, that's not my question, but that's a basic aspect of it. It seems to me that the tax cut being proposed is as likely to drain or suppress the economy as to stimulate it. And let me give you two examples. For example,
very quickly,
in Texas, they had a long-term forecast that was wrong, and they now have a large deficit. Should that happen to our economy, it'll be drained by the interest paid on the deficit. That's an example. Second example, I have many investments. If I know the capital gains tax is going to go down in 3 years, and this is going to be a tax cut that's being put in over 10 years, I'm not going to move any more money than I have to until it goes down. The same thing goes for income. I've got some income in trust accounts that I could defer, and I'll defer it if I know my income tax is going to be lower in each subsequent year. So possibly this could suppress the economy, and I think if they had any interest really in moving the economy.
Well, let's just listen to what Mr. Bush said last night or yesterday about defending his tax cut.
I'm aware that this economy is beginning to sputter a little bit, and it makes sense to combine good monetary policy with good fiscal policy. I believe by giving people some of your own money back, it'll help kickstart this economy so people will be able to find work who's looking for a job.
Cece, what do you think about what Robin was, the points that Robin was raising?
Let me start with the caveat that I'm no economist, but in my experience covering this campaign and Congress, a couple points. This is a good, legitimate debate to be having in this country right now in terms of what's the best way to stimulate the economy. And I'm not necessarily going to come down on one side or the other this morning, but I would issue a little bit of a caution from covering George Bush on the campaign trail. Do not underestimate this man. He has some difficulty with the English language, and I'm not certain why that is. And many people suggest that he's not necessarily intellectually curious, but he is not dumb. And the people around him are quite experienced in the corporate world as well as in government. Don't underestimate them.
Let's go back to our callers, 1-800-423-8255. Frank is on the line. Frank, welcome to The Connection.
Hi there. The woman that just spoke actually took the thunder out of everything I had to say.
Do you still want to say something?
I still, of course, I want my own talk show.
George, no, you don't.
Well, do you have any suggestions, John?
No.
Where I can apply? Okay. The fact of the matter is, I think George W. Bush has been given a bad turn by just about everybody from NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, and the Boston Globe and the New York Times.
You left out National Public Radio.
I did National Public Radio, right? I left them out. They're one of the biggest culprits. Now, in all fairness, explain where I'm coming from here. I am a Ronald Reagan Republican. I've actually talked to you before. But I'm also a 60s liberal. I've got this dichotomy in my brain. But so, and it strikes me as totally unfair that the press continually talks about George Bush's inability to be something like John F. Kennedy or his lack of intellectual ability. It's unfair. And the whole 30 days after the Florida vote, I just hear so much what I consider misinformation. I'm jumbling up too many things at once here, I know.
Well, let's talk to Andy Cohut and ask him about your point. Do you find out there, Andy, in your polling that...
Well, the public thinks that the press is, by and large, fair to Bush, but the fairness ratings for the press for Bush are lower than the ratings that we found in 93 for Clinton and in 89 for Bush Sr., when larger numbers said that the press was being fair to the new president. Now, that may reflect, in part, the way the George W. Bush came to office. But, you know, I think another element in all of this is the amount of attention that President Clinton has received and his problems have received, and that's sort of taken away from the showcasing of George W. Bush and his personally and his policies in particular. And even yesterday, Bush hits the road, and what dominates the news but an earthquake? I mean, he can't seem to get on the front page and at the top of the newscast.
Mr. Cohen, are you...
So, Frank, let me just jump in and ask you a question. Does George W. Bush ring your bells the same way Ronald Reagan did?
No, he doesn't. But that's part of the problem. I think we are, because of the last 8 years of Bill Clinton, we have come used to a president of the United States talking, being like a show business celebrity, talking about his underwear on television and just this whole nine yards of the Clinton scandal. And so what becomes difficult for me is when people criticize, and I don't trust the polls. I don't trust any damn poll, I tell you right now. I think that the darn fact of the matter is that we're expecting some kind of Elvis Presley as president, and what we've got is a decent human being.
Cece, do you think... Frank, thanks a lot for your call. Cece, do you think George W. Bush has any Elvis potential?
Oh, absolutely. not like the second Elvis, namely Bill Clinton. He's one of a kind. But... You know, I spoke to some of the House Democrats after George Bush visited their retreat in Pennsylvania several weeks ago, and he worked that room full of skeptical Democrats. You know, one thing I wanted to mention here, though, on the notion of sort of president as entertainer in chief and just sort of what's going on in our society, I found it fascinating that Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton's former chief of staff, said that was the last campaign speech, because it was really the Clintonites who perfected the role that the campaign never ends and that governing nowadays is very much about campaigning.
The road goes on forever. The party never ends. I mean, he's out on the road now.
Absolutely.
Very much like campaigning.
Cece, I can't help but believe that George W. Bush is going to be Pat Boone to Bill Clinton's Elvis.
You're probably right.
Andy, is it accurate to say that you found only 43% of the American public backing the tax cut? And I have to be very quick because I have to get it.
Yes, but, you know, the numbers are all over the place because the American public hasn't quite figured out what this tax cut means in specific terms. It's a moving target.
Andy Kohut, the director of the Pew Research Center. Thank you very much for being with us, Andy.
Well, you're welcome.
You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Tell us what you think about George W. Bush. I'm John.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection with host John McChesney, the Kreutzer Sonata.
And career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about our president, George W. Bush. One of the things that puzzles me, Cece, is, and Cece Connolly is here with me in the studio. She's a reporter for the Washington Post. One of the things that puzzles me about this tax cut business is that so far the polling figures I've seen is that there's no clamor out there amongst the American public for a tax cut. I mean, there's a modest, as we were talking earlier with the one pollster, there's a modest demand for this, but it's just not something that's at the top of the American concern. And yet for George W. Bush, it's the number one concern. It's the most important thing he can think of. So why is that? Why do the Republicans jam these tax cuts like this?
Well, I think politically, tax cuts have always been a bedrock Republican Party principle. Much of this goes to ideological philosophy, certainly. But let's be fair here. The Democrats on Capitol Hill would like to put through some tax cuts and tax relief as well. It's a matter of who would be getting the tax cut that this argument is going to be over.
And that argument, I mean, I was doing a little scanning here. I was a little surprised. The top 5% of the country, according to figures I found, pay 40% of the taxes. It's a pretty good whack for the top 5%. Sounds like that may have something to do with the Republican desire to push through a tax cut.
Sure. The Democratic criticism is, well, this is just a sop to the rich. What President Bush responds is that those folks are paying the bulk of the taxes, so they should get the bulk of the tax relief.
They get a, by the figures I've read, would be like an 8. He wants to drop it to 33%. That would be a 6.6% reduction for them. But the bottom part is only getting a 5% reduction. I mean, if you're talking in percentages, it's a little off there. I can see why the Democrats might have a point. I'm going to go down to another guest now, who's down in Houston, Texas, at Rice University. Earl Black. He's a professor of political science there. He's been watching George W. Bush for a long time. Earl, are we seeing Mr. Bush emerge from the enigma that people have wondered about as they watched him during the campaign? You've seen something emerge that you hadn't seen before?
Actually, I think what we're seeing now is the Bush who has been visible in Texas and primarily to Texans for some time. It's a very different political style. It's one where, as governor of Texas, he worked first with Democratic majorities in both houses of the Texas legislature. And then toward the end of his service, the Republicans managed a narrow lead in the Texas State Senate. So he's had this necessity to try to put together some kind of bipartisan coalitions. And the style is one in which I think Bush is probably more comfortable in small settings, intimate settings. In a way, he reminds me of another Texas president, Lyndon Johnson, in his speech the other night. Reminded me of Lyndon Johnson's first speech after the Kennedy assassination, when Johnson came before the nation on television, a very awkward public speaker, much more awkward than George Bush.
And a tortured soul, so far we haven't seen.
Yes, but radiated sincerity and actually put the nation on the road to passing the Civil Rights Act.
John, if I
which
could
John
ask,
Kennedy had never been able to do.
CeCe Conley?
Earl, I'm curious, I'm puzzling today, and maybe you've got some insight on this. The House Republicans, one day after President Bush gives this big bipartisanship speech, the House Republicans stand up and say, we're going to shove this thing through the House by next week. That doesn't sound as if the House Republicans and the Republican president are coordinating.
Isn't that a problem, Earl, that he had with his Republicans down in Texas?
Certainly, he's going to find Republicans in the House as well as Texas Republicans who would be far to his right. What I think Bush brings to the process is this element of civility, and I think that may if he can keep that up. Use the White House bully pulpit for that purpose, then I think he has the chance to restore a serious dialogue that may eventually, not now, but eventually get beyond just the narrow partisanship that has been so shrill on both sides, I think, for the last decade or so.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to John on the line from Buffalo, New York.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, John.
I'd like to put this up to your panelists. It seems to me that there's a real disconnect between what George Bush says and what is actually happening. For instance, in the speech he talks about lingering racism and stamping that out. On the other hand, he's in his budget removing block grant funds that go to things like midnight basketball and so on. And there's other evidence of that as well, the vouchers that he's so much in favor of, which would siphon money out of inner-city schools. Seems like, to me, that the chattel conservatism that he preaches is very different from the actions that are going on behind the scenes.
Earl Black, do you think that was just a rhetorical flourish in that speech, or was it something genuine that you were able to watch?
No, I think Bush actually has a very different approach, If compassion is defined in terms of things like midnight basketball, then I think Bush that's certainly not his priority. But what I think he is really interested in trying to do, and of course it would take a long time to do this if it ever happens, and the odds perhaps are against him. But I really think based on what he's done in Texas that Bush's orientation is really to move the Republican Party back more in the direction of the party of Lincoln. But he's doing it through traditional Republican means, which basically mean empower individuals and less of a reliance upon government programs and bureaucracy to accomplish things. I think you see that in the proposed Social Security reform and so forth.
I'd like to respond to that.
Sure.
Go ahead, John.
I don't see how removing funds from inner city programs is empowering individuals who have very little power. To me, that's just a bad idea.
Well, I think what Bush would like to do, if he could get the kind of Social Security reform that he's talking about, then I think that would be a way to empower all Americans across all lines of race, class, dimension, and so forth, much more important than some of the specific bureaucracy-oriented programs that we've had in the past.
Cece, you buy that?
I'm not certain. There are a lot of doubts and questions about Bush's partial privatization plans for Social Security. Mainly, we're just not certain that the money is there. And if you notice, President Bush hasn't been talking much about that one in particular. But I think as a political reporter and political junkie, what excites me is we're going to get a fundamentally very different approach to governing than what we've had for the past 8 years. And the American public is going to get to see and choose, really, which route they want to take.
They'll have that choice in 2 years when the House comes up. If the House misbehaves in the eyes of the American public, that could turn things around very quickly for Mr. Bush. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Kathy's on the line. Kathy, welcome to The Connection.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to toss something out to your panel that it just seems to me, in listening to Bush's address, there seems to be this undercurrent of this feeling of the government is there and the people are here. And it seems to me, if we're talking bipartisanship, this is a classic split between a Republican saying, here's your money, do what you want with it, the tax refund is your money, take it home and do what you want with it, versus whatever happened to this, it's our money. The government is our money. Why is it big government instead of using our money to help our people?
There could be a concept of tax. Maybe this is what you're saying, that there's a concept of taxation that says you're paying your dues to belong to this society and to use it as an economic platform to make your fortune. And so you pay your dues. It's not just something the government steals from you.
Right. But it just seems that in all of the rhetoric that's coming out of this, it seems to be somewhat divisive in terms of call your representative and say, I want my money back. I want my money back, too, in a better government, in stronger education and stronger health care. And isn't that getting my money back? Isn't that getting a refund?
Earl, would that play down in Texas?
Well, I think in Texas, the public sentiment, I think, would be much more with President Bush. Certainly not universal, but that would be the central tendency. And I think that the response of the Bush people would be that we're not closing down government. In fact, almost the first half of Bush's speech was devoted to trying to say, here's how we're investing in these traditional functions of the national government. But at the same time, the fact that you now have a surplus, I think, does put Bush in a stronger position than many presidents have been in that they can return to this proposition that the government gets its money from the productivity of its citizens. And what Bush says in terms of it's your money, I think particularly for Republicans and a lot of conservative independents, that would be common sense. That would be actually a breath of fresh air for a lot of those people. Obviously, on the other side, it's not viewed that way at all.
1-800-423-8255. We want to hear from you. David is on a line from Iowa City. Let's jump out to the heartland and see what's going on out there. David, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you very much. I love your show. Well, I had all my lines lined up before we went on hold listening to all this, and I'll just kind of make some points and see what everybody's thoughts are. One is, I was raised an Air Force brat. My dad worked for the military in the Naval Training Support Center, actually dealing with radar guidance control systems. And I can only tell you, and of course it's only third party, But Billy has sold us out far beyond anything we're going to recognize, militarily and economically. And more importantly, I was raised, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think everything around Bill Clinton has been one scandal after another. And I'm just really confused on why half of the world here.
We're talking about George here. Let's talk about George W.
Thank you. I'll do that. I apologize.
I know it's nice to.
I really like George W. Bush a lot. Earlier you spoke about the tax breaks and et cetera, and those who are rich, et cetera. I happened to meet George Bush when he came to Cedar Rapids last year, and happened to have gotten paid that day, and I'm what you would call a rich person. I do just over $100,000 in income, and my tax bracket is 39.8%. On that day that he was there, I happened to have gotten my paycheck, and I signed it, and I said, you don't have to give lip service anymore. Here's my paycheck with my signature, where I work, and what was paid out. And I said, it's basic math, but it's 39.8%. So I'm one of those rich people, and if I get a tax break of something coming back to me, I can assure you it goes right back into the economy through buying purchasing of goods and products that hopefully are made right here in America, although that seems to be going south these days. And if we look at George W. Bush, appreciate the man for who he is. He puts his
okay, David.
On.
We're going to appreciate him for who he is. You put a dollar sign on that tax cut. Thank you, from David from Iowa City. We're running out of time here, and I want to give Cece a chance to come back in here and kind of look forward and tell us what you think is around the corner. We've got the House now going to jam this thing through. They say next week they're going to put it up for a vote. What happens in the Senate?
That's right. In the Senate, as you know, John, we've got the 50-50 split, and Vice President Cheney will probably be hanging around Capitol Hill a lot in the coming months to try and cast tie-breaking votes from time to time. I think that in the Senate, there will be a much longer, closer inspection and dissection of not only President Bush's tax cut proposal, but the budget. There'll be much more wrangling, haggling. I suspect it'll come down in size a bit because we're hearing from skeptical Republican senators.
Earl Black, very briefly, do you think people will start coming around to David's point of view when they're looking at their paychecks?
Well, I think the country's divided on that score and probably will remain so. I think we've got such a narrow Republican advantage in both houses of Congress now that Bush is going to have to compromise on his bold proposals. That's what he did in Texas, and that's ultimately, I think, what he's going to have to do in Washington.
Earl Black, professor of political science down at Rice University in Houston, Texas, thank you very much for being with us on The Connection. Cece Connolly, thank you for being with us. Cece's a political reporter for The Washington Post and is hanging out over at Harvard for a while, taking it easy.
John, thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Connection. I'm John McChesney, The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio.
For The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.